It's nearly noon, and it's time for your KMXT Midday Report. You're listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station. We're also streaming live on the web at kmxt.org and in HD 1, 2, and 3. Coming up on your Midday Report, Alaska Aerospace has set a new launch window. The August primary election has seen some places move around. The Alaska Marine Highway Reshaping Work Group will be taking public comment. A report concerning the fatal mid-air crash of Representative Gary Knopf. An air service in Dutch Harbor. Currently 55 degrees today here in downtown Kodiak. We're looking for scattered showers, mainly after 1 p.m. today. For tonight, showers are likely, mainly after 10 p.m. Cloudy skies overnight with a low around 51. South winds will be about 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, rain is likely.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Hurricane Laura is bearing down on the U.S. Gulf Coast. The powerful Category 4 storm is packing 140-mile-per-hour winds and is forecast to make landfall later tonight. NPR's John Burnett is along the Texas-Louisiana border, where evacuation orders are in effect.
These cities are just empty now. You can see that folks have really taken these warnings to heart when they realized that this was going to be a Category 4, those are very destructive winds. And so people have packed up and they have gone to Baton Rouge. They've gone north to Shreveport. They've gone west to Houston. They want to get out of here.
NPR's John Burnett reporting. Vice President Mike Pence will deliver his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention tonight. NPR's Don Gagne reports President Trump is also expected to make another appearance during the evening as planned.
Vice President Pence, with his button-down style, provides a contrast to the outsized personality and self-promotion of President Trump on the GOP ticket. The Trump campaign says Pence will speak in, quote, optimistic tones about a second term for the Trump administration. He's also expected to praise the administration's handling of the coronavirus pandemic that has now claimed the lives of more than 177,000 Americans. Also speaking tonight, presidential advisor Kellyanne Conway, who, citing family pressures, is leaving her White House job at the end of the month. Her husband and her teenage daughter are both vocal Trump critics. Don Gagne, NPR News, Washington.
Police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, have arrested and charged a 17-year-old suspect with first-degree intentional homicide in the shooting deaths of two protesters. The city has seen three straight nights of demonstrations following a police shooting that left a black man critically injured. Chuck Quirnbach of member station WUWM reports tensions are mounting amid reports that groups of armed civilians are confronting protesters on the city streets.
Around 11 p.m. Tuesday, law enforcement forced demonstrators out of downtown. About a half hour later, three people were shot, and authorities now say they've arrested Kyle Rittenhouse, a juvenile from Antioch, Illinois. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers announced he's authorizing another 250 Wisconsin National Guard troops to help local law enforcement in Kenosha this evening. Evers says the Guard will also protect the ability of individuals to peacefully protest. On Twitter, President Donald Trump says he's sending federal law enforcement to Kenosha to, quote, restore law and order. For NPR News, I'm Chuck Quirnbach in Milwaukee.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. The Tour de France kicks off in the French city of Nice on Saturday. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the annual bike race was scheduled to be held in July but was postponed amid the coronavirus pandemic.
Changing the race from July to September, when people are back at school and work, is expected to cut the crowds way back. And this year's fans will be kept at least 2 meters from riders who will operate in their own bubble. The riders will have to undergo COVID tests along with regular doping tests. Even journalists covering the race must be tested for the virus. Tour de France director Christian Prudhomme says the whole operation has been scaled back about 40% with fewer cars and a smaller publicity caravan. But the fundamentals of the world's most grueling and iconic cycling race haven't changed. 176 riders will cycle nearly 2,200 miles across the valleys, mountains, and villages of France for a grand finale September 20th on the Champs-Élysées. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Several countries in Europe continue to report fresh outbreaks of the coronavirus. Officials in France, Germany, Italy, and Spain are warning about a potential spillover to vulnerable populations as infection rates rise among young people. Officials in France are reinforcing face mask orders after a record number of new coronavirus cases this week. Facial coverings are now mandatory in French companies, and all teachers and students must wear them when schools reopen next week. All of the major indices were trading higher just before the closing bell on Wall Street at last check. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 83 points, the S&P up 35. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
Alaska Aerospace has set the next launch window at the Kodiak Pacific Spaceport from between Sunday, August 30th and Thursday, September 3rd. The Passaic Road to Fossil Beach could be closed on those days from between 2 in the afternoon until 9 at night. Waterway restrictions could be in places as well at those dates for 3 hours starting at 6 in the evening. Earlier this month, Astra, a California-based aerospace company, tried several times to send a rocket into space, but those launches were scrubbed due to a number of problems, from a boat that strayed into the safety zone to high wind shears and other technical delays. The company hopes to successfully test its 3.1 rocket, smaller in size and designed to drive down the costs of sending telecommunications satellites into space. On Friday, at 3 p.m. in the Anchorage Legislative Information Office, the Senate Resources Committee will hold a hearing to take public testimony on and consider Governor Mike Dunleavy's appointees to the Board of Fisheries. They are John Jensen, Mackenzie Mitchell, Abe Williams, and John Wood. Senator Pete Michiki, Republican of Soldotna, chairman of the Senate Resources Committee, said, quote, "Without knowing if a special session will occur prior to the 2021 legislative session, and considering the importance of the Board of Fish process to Alaskans, we felt it was important to review and provide the public opportunity to weigh in about specific appointees to the BOF. Friday's meeting will provide that opportunity. Our hope is that fishing Alaskans will engage respectfully toward a robust discussion while the results of the 2020 fishing season are still fresh in their minds. Members of the public can testify over the phone and submit written testimony to SRES@aklege.gov. Public testimony call-in numbers from all other areas than Anchorage and Juneau is 844-586-9085. The August primary election seesaw moved up and down yesterday, with some candidates rising and others falling, but Kodiak Senator Gary Stevens was one of those who saw a reversal of fortunes. On election night, he was trailing behind his challenger John Cox, an Anchor Point store owner. But yesterday's count gave Stevens about 51% of the vote and a lead of about 69 votes. One of the ironies is that a week ago, when Cox was in the lead, he also had 69 votes, the exact same margin that Stevens has now. Duncan Fields, Republican chairman for District 34, which takes in some of the Kenai Peninsula and all of Kodiak Island, says absentee ballots typically track with election night results.
But this year we have this curveball, which is COVID, and we have a disproportionate amount of people that voted absentee. Because of COVID, those absentee ballots may not necessarily reflect the same proportionality as the general election.
On the other hand, Fields says, turnout is often poor during the primaries, which could in the end benefit Cox because he had the support of a small, concentrated group of very conservative voters who turned out on Election Day. Senator Tom Begich, a Democrat from Anchorage who has been following this race closely, believes that Stevens supporters were more likely to vote absentee.
Gary himself has been a strong proponent of mask wearing and ensuring that people vote safely. So my guess is the bulk of his constituents took his advice, and that's why you'll see him in the end prevail.
Begich predicts that Stevens will wind up by about a 200-vote margin, the victor. However, it turns out, political observers say it's interesting to follow this race to the end, especially given that Stevens has held the Senate seat since 2003. They also say it's a reminder to incumbents not to let their guard down during primary season, no matter how many times they've been reelected, because a highly motivated candidate can take advantage of the historically poor turnout during Alaska primaries, especially in fishing communities when the primary election season is the busiest time of year. Also, closed Republican primaries tend to favor more conservative candidates over moderates like Stevens. Another thing that makes this race one to watch, the two candidates represent very different constituencies. Stevens voters come from a maritime culture which values programs like Alaska Marine Highway System, while Cox draws his support from voters with a more urban mindset who live on the road system and don't need some of the programs that support life in some of the district's more remote communities. They also tend to favor cuts to government spending and a full permanent fund dividend based on the traditional distribution formula, which Stevens did not support. This year, a record number of absentee ballots were cast. The Anchorage Daily News reports that more than 54,000 absentee ballots were uncounted at the start of Tuesday. By the end of the day, almost 33,000 of those ballots were counted. Another 21,000 ballots could potentially be counted if they arrived by Friday and were postmarked on Election Day. So stay tuned. Round and around she goes. Only two more days to find out who wins and who loses in a number of races that are just too close to call. Today is the first in a series of two hearings in the state ferry system that may determine its future. The Alaska Marine Highway Reshaping Work Group will take public comment this afternoon. The group is looking at a variety of ways to keep the ferry system going. One of the ideas so far, to create a new quasi-government entity similar to the Alaska Railroad, insulated from annual legislative processes. Another is to find out a way to fund the system so it can be managed with a long-term outlook. The group has already ruled out privatizing the system based on a $250,000 study commissioned by the governor's office. Privatization doesn't pencil out. The Department of Transportation will stream today's meeting on its website starting at 3 this afternoon and ending at 6. The number to call in and testify is 844-586-9085. A new report from the National Transportation Safety Board says that an Alaska lawmaker piloting one of the planes in last month's fatal mid-air crash near Soldotna had been denied a required medical certificate 8 years ago because of vision problems. NTSB Alaska Chief Clint Johnson says it's too soon to say whether Representative Gary Knopf's reported vision issues played a role in that crash, but it's still part of the investigation.
We don't know. Again, very, very early. We have a lot of work to do.
NTSB investigators found that Knopf had appealed the denial of his medical certificate in 2012 and lost. Federal air regulators require the certificate to fly. Investigators say Knopf was alone in his small plane in the morning of July 31st when he took off from Soldotna Airport with plans to head to Fairbanks. The report described the skies as clear and calm. Just to the northeast, a small plane operated by High Adventure Air Charter left Longmuir Lake at the same time. Greg Bell, an owner of the company, piloted the plane. He had five passengers, a fishing guide from Kansas, and four South Carolina residents. The NTSB says minutes after takeoff, the two planes collided midair. A witness told investigators that Knopf's plane hit the left side of Bell's. Johnson says investigators are examining the wreckage and trying to map out what happened leading up to the crash.
The foundation of the investigation is to try and figure out how these airplanes came together, the convergence angles, and to basically see, number one, if each pilot or both pilots were able to see each other.
Johnson says it could be a year or more until the NTSB establishes a probable cause of the crash. Two airlines are vying to resume direct flights connecting Unalaska with Anchorage. Servant Air and Float Alaska have each made filings stating they would like to fill the gap left by Raven, which filed for bankruptcy earlier this year. Servant Air has asked for a $2.9 million subsidy for the route. The Kodiak-based airline promises 10 round trips between Unalaska and Anchorage and an additional 20 round trips between Unalaska and its Kodiak hub, which has a hospital, Walmart, and regular connections with Alaska Airlines. Float Alaska is tied to Float Shuttle, a relatively new Southern California-based commuter airline that purchased Raven's core assets in a bankruptcy auction this summer. The company says it intends to resume flying some of Raven's hub routes next month. Float Alaska's one-paragraph proposal to service on Alaska doesn't ask for any federal money. It promises subsidy-free service to Dutch Harbor on Alaska, meeting or exceeding minimum service levels with Dash 8 aircraft. It did not provide any details on cost or frequency of flights if it were selected. Unalaska has been without regularly scheduled commercial flights to Anchorage since April, when Raven Air Group declared bankruptcy and grounded their entire fleet. That prompted the Unalaska City Council to ask the U.S. Department of Transportation to start the process to bring essential air service to Unalaska. Unalaska Mayor Vince Tuchikoff Sr. says elected officials have an important role to play.
If we as a community or a city like one of the airlines that are out there, we can have an impact on the decision with DOT. We can have that impact.
The City of Unalaska has submitted a comment stressing Unalaska needs direct, safe, reliable, and affordable flights, but they do not indicate a strong preference for carriers. Their letter does raise concerns about Servant Air's ability to meet community demand with the smaller King Air 350 aircraft. Tuesday is the last day to comment on the two proposals. It's unclear when federal transportation authorities will announce their decision. Four Alaskans died of COVID-19, the Department of Health and Social Services announced Tuesday. That's the highest single-day count since the pandemic started. But the Department of Health and Social Services says in an announcement on Facebook that two of the deaths were from several weeks ago, including one in mid-July. DHSS says that the deaths were identified during a routine review of death certificates. The state reported 37 new cases of COVID-19, one of the lowest case counts in recent weeks, but the number of people hospitalized with or under investigation of having the disease continues to gradually rise. There are now 40 people hospitalized with the disease and another 6 under investigation for having COVID-19. 3 regions in the state are also back on high alert level based on their case rate. Those include the urban hubs around Anchorage and Juneau, as well as an area in the northern Alaska stretching from the Bering Straits to the North Slope. Based on state data, Pacific Islanders in Alaska are about 4 times more likely to be hospitalized than the general population. They're also 8 times more likely to contract COVID-19. Lucy Hansen, president of the Polynesian Association of Alaska, says part of the reason for the high rates is a culture where it's customary to be physically close.
We're a culture that we love to hug and we love to kiss, and it's like it's the way we show our love and affections.
It's also part of the culture that large families and church groups tend to gather. And she says community get-togethers and church services have been a conduit for transmission in Alaska. Hansen has been meeting with city and state officials who alerted her to the disparity, and they are working together to get the word out. Some members of the community do not speak English as their first language, and Hansen has been volunteering time to translate health resources. She says that some information is incorrectly translated, but for the most part, the community is getting the message.
It just have to remind each other, you know, that it's very real. It's not something that you joke around with.
Economic factors also play a role in certain groups' transmission, hospitalization, and death rates. Pacific Islanders and Alaska Natives are also more likely to live in crowded, multi-generational housing where the virus is more easily spread. Alaska Natives and American Indians are over 1.5 times more likely to contract the virus and almost twice as likely to be hospitalized if they do. Alaska Natives in rural Alaska may also live in houses that lack adequate sanitation, which is another risk factor. Dr. Bob Anders is a medical director in the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. He says that these problems were identified during the H1N1 pandemic a decade ago. He says, unfortunately, though, not much has changed in intervening years.
Even in the urban setting, there may be other factors that create populations, including Alaska Natives, that may have a higher risk. And the same thing is the multi-generational housing, potentially challenges with housing that may exist even in the urban setting as the rural setting.
Anders is hopeful that talking about these healthcare disparities will push leaders to address decades-old problems in housing and sanitation.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Pinks have pushed Alaska salmon catch past the 100 million mark. More after this.
Fish Radio is brought to you by Alaska Boats and Permits in Homer, marine broker for vessels, permits, and IFQs. Online at alaskaboat.com.
Alaska's statewide salmon catch has passed two important benchmarks over the past week, breaking the 100 million salmon mark and a continued push of pinks on its way to 53 million humpies. About three-quarters of the pink salmon landings have come from Prince William Sound at 21 million and Kodiak at nearly 20 million. That's almost 60% more pinks than expected for Kodiak fishermen. Cook Inlet's catch of 2.7 million humpies is that region's only good catch this summer. Fewer than 6 million pinks have been landed at Southeast, down by half of the forecast. Nearly 220,000 sockeyes were landed last week, with 90% coming from Kodiak and the Alaska Peninsula and Aleutians region. Alaska's total sockeye catch so far is at 45 million reds. Chums continue to be the biggest bust, with total catches barely topping 5 million fish. That's roughly one quarter of the total projection for the season. Fewer than 2 million chums have been caught at Southeast. At Alaska's farthest north chum fishery at Kotzebue, buyers are packing it up due to the lowest harvest in well over a decade. Alaska's coho harvest has just topped 1 million. Still, the catch is off by nearly 60% of the five-year average, but there's at least another 5 weeks or so to go. Chinook landings of less than 200,000 are off by more than 30% from last year. Finally, the last day to comment on whether the October Board of Fisheries meeting should be done virtually, in person, or postponed is August 31st. Find links to that survey and to comment on the Board of Fisheries appointees at alaskafishradio.com. Our salmon updates are compiled by the McDowell Group for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Fish Radio is also brought to you by Ocean Beauty Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Fish Radio is supported in part by Joy Crafts, specializing in marine safety equipment. U.S. Coast Guard approved AMC instruction for commercial fishing vessel safety procedures and drills, serving Kodiak for over 25 years. 486-6293 at 445 Shahafka Circle.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement Number 34, date issued 10 a.m. on August 26. The Iqaluit Bay section of the Afognak District, south of a line from Haystack Rock to Pillar Cape, will open to commercial salmon fishing at noon Thursday, August 27th, and remain open until further notice. As previously announced, the Duck Bay section of the Afognak District will open for a 78-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Wednesday, August 26th to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 29th. There will be a 72-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 6 p.m. Wednesday, August 26th to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 29th in the following areas. In the Outer Karluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Central and North Cape sections of the Northwest Kodiak District, the Southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District, and the Humpy Dead Man, Cape Alatak, Alatak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alatak District. There will be a 54-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Thursday, August 27th to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 29th in the following areas. In the Inner Iqaluk and Outer Iqaluk sections of the Southwest Kodiak District, waters will be open to stream terminus of Iqaluk River, stream number 256201. In the Sheratine Bay, Kajuyak Bay, Terror Bay, Uganic Bay, sections of the Northwest Kodiak District, and the Southeast Afognak, Raspberry Strait, Northwest Afognak, Shuyak Island, Paul's Bay, Paranosa Bay, and Northeast Afognak sections of the Afognak District, the Big River, Hallow Bay, Outer Kukak Bay, Dakovac Bay, Katmai and Alinchak sections of the mainland district north of latitude of Cape Kekernoy at 57 degrees 43.5 north latitude, on the east side Kodiak district and the northeast Kodiak district. As previously announced, the following areas remain open until further notice: the Izua Bay section of the Afognak district north of a latitude from Haystack Rock to Pillar Cape, and until further notice in that portion of the northwest and the southwest Kodiak districts, south of a latitude of Cape Kuliuk, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart, detailed in Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations, and statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office, and of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
It's Wednesday, the 26th of August, year 2020. Sun rose today at 6:57, will set again at 9:25 p.m., giving us 14 hours and 23 minutes of daylight. That is a loss of 4 minutes and 50 seconds compared to yesterday. Looking at our local tides, here on the east side, we have a low tide coming up at 2:08 p.m. That's going to be a 2.9-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 8:44 this evening, an 8.4-foot tide. Over on the west side, these are Uganic Bay tides, you have a low tide coming up at 3:01 p.m. That's going to be a 4.5-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 9:09 this evening of 13.3 feet. Currently 56 degrees here in Kodiak. Pretty pleasant. A little rain is coming down. We're looking for scattered showers mainly after 1 today. For tomorrow, look for likely rain mainly before 4 p.m. Cloudy skies with a high near 61. Similar conditions are expected to go through Monday night, and they're talking about sunny skies on Tuesday. For your marine weather, here's your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A 1,005 millibar low, 30 nautical miles southwest of Middleton Island, will dissipate onshore this evening. A 1,004 millibar low, 50 nautical miles south of Kodiak City, will merge with a 1,000 millibar low, 200 nautical miles west of Ketchikan by Thursday evening. The resulting weather, Marmot Island, Sitkanak offshore on the east side here of Kodiak. Small craft advisory Thursday. Tonight we're looking at south winds becoming variable after midnight, increasing to 25 knots tomorrow afternoon north of Dangerous Cape, variable 10. Chiniak and Marmot Bays, variable less than 10, becoming south 15 knots this afternoon, northwest 10 tomorrow, seas of 2 feet. Marmot Bay, similar conditions, west 10 will become southeast 15 this afternoon. Seas 2 feet will build to 4 feet in Marmot Bay this afternoon. Over in the Shelikof, small craft advisory tomorrow. We have variable winds of 10 knots tonight, becoming north 15 after midnight and increasing to 25 knots tomorrow on our west side, seas building to 7 feet. Kodiak City Council will hold a regular council meeting tomorrow. The meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. in the Borough Assembly Chambers. The meeting is open to the public, and the public will be asked to wear a mask and social distance if you attend in person. For additional information, call the City Clerk's Office at 486-8636. Also, the Kodiak Island Borough Solid Waste Advisory Board will meet tonight at 5:15 p.m. in the Borough Assembly Chambers. The public is welcome to attend. Masks are required when attending in person. For questions about the swab meeting, call 486-9343.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT two times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.